It's a fair question. Let me repeat the question in case you've gone here. The question was a very simple one. How would you define MKS? I think the core of MKS is about sort of the study of the computational universe and what exists in the computational universe. What do I mean by the computational universe? I mean the systems that can be defined by explicit rules, the kind of ones that are most amenable to kind of a basic scientific study are the ones where the rules are simple. What do I mean by simple? As an operational matter, what I mean by simple is that they're kind of small enough that we can realistically find them by doing some kind of enumerative search. I think that's kind of the core idea, the core sort of center of MKS. Is the study and investigation of the computational universe. That's kind of pure MKS, the study of what systems with all possible kinds of simple rules can do. And coming out from that are all of its applications and all of the kinds of implications that the things that we see in the computational universe have for our ways of thinking about other things in the world. Yes?
What portion of MKS is cellular automata?
Okay. What portion of MKS is cellular automata? Cellular automata are my first and favorite example of many of the phenomena in MKS. One of the things that we learn from this sort of principle of computational equivalence is that across all these very different kinds of systems that we might study, many of the same kinds of phenomena will inevitably occur. Cellular automata have the nice feature that they're very visual, they're very easy to kind of get an intuitive impression of. And that's why I tend to use them as examples of many kinds of things. They're also, of all the various kinds of systems that one studies in MKS, they're the ones that kind of got a head start in terms of time over the others, because I started really talking about them in the early 80s, and they've had quite a history even before that, although not so much in actually modeling things and so on. Kind of that head start has meant that in terms of practical models that people have made using kind of MKS ideas, there's been kind of a 15 or 20 year kind of a jump that cellular automata have had on other kinds of things. I think that the there's nothing, cellular automata, you could learn much of what there is to know in terms of kind of the fundamental phenomena of MKS by studying cellular automata, but there are, in terms of the applications of MKS, for example, there are lots of other types of systems which are much more readily relevant for particular applications. I mean, for example, in my efforts to study fundamental physics, cellular automata will be the wrong place to start. I think that the sort of rigidity of cellular automata and their kind of assumption of a geometry that is what we're familiar with in space isn't the place to start when we want to kind of go below existing physics and kind of see what we can build space up from and so on. And there, for example, these systems that are based on simple kind of combinatorial networks are much more what I think is relevant. Yes?
Who first used the term computational universe?
Who first used the term computational universe? Probably I did, but I don't know. That's actually a term that I would guess that I did. I don't know. We can go look on the web and go do the computational history.
And when you use the first time?
Gosh, I don't know. I was using it when I was working on the MKS book in the 1990s. I don't know whether that was. I don't know whether that term had come up in what I was doing with cellular automata. It's a perfectly good question, and I should know the answer because I pay attention to these kinds of things, but I don't. I'll try to find out. Yes?
How about reverse engineering in case cellular automata? I mean, at the moment, we're just searching space for all possible programs and hoping we come across something interesting. You know, it's much more, it's to go backwards, start the problem, and is there a cellular
right. Right, so the question is about reverse engineering from phenomena to find underlying rules like cellular automata. One thing that one learns from sort of MKS is that it is conceivable to find things just by searching. that might be completely inconceivable, because it might be that anything that would be interesting enough to care about would be so complicated you could never possibly find it by some kind of exhaustive search method. What I found surprisingly often with MKS is that these exhaustive searches actually do work, because there are simple enough things out there that that correspond to the phenomena one's interested in that one can find them. Now, as I say, there's I think one of the most important methodological developments that will happen with MKS in the next few years is learning how to do those searches better and better. When we look at an area like statistics, for example, which is kind of the analog of the reverse engineering problem for traditional kind of calculus-based science, the sort of early methods of statistics are very weak in terms of their kind of ability to search out the space of parameters. As times have gone forward, we've seen sort of global optimization methods and things like this, which are a little bit black arty. They're not terribly systematic. But nevertheless, they are often in practice useful in finding sort of the optimal parameters for some particular model and so on. I think when it comes to searching for programs instead of parameters, we have to take different approaches. I don't know if that's an important area for development. I don't know what the best approaches are. We've tried, over the course of years, many different methods for trying to sort of speed up the process of doing searches. There are very obvious kinds of prunings that you can do to avoid searching through programs that obviously aren't going to work. But I don't know. Whenever we've tried to do sort of incremental methods that kind of, let's say, emulate natural selection in biology or something, it's not been useful. What tends to happen, we can now actually do fairly systematic studies. We've done exhaustive searches. We know what some actual optimal answers are, and we can compare that with what we can get to by searching those same spaces with more incremental methods. We just don't get there. I suppose the most extreme example of all of this is searching for the fundamental theory of physics, where kind of the one of the things that happens in that case, and that's a more extreme version of what happens in many other kinds of searching problems. Not only do you have a big space to search possible models, but even when you have a candidate model, you're kind of bitten by computational irreducibility in figuring out what the consequences of that model are. So kind of on the front lines of the universe hunt, what one is actually doing is to try to take a potential model for the universe and to try to say, could this particular simple program be a realistic model for the universe? So how does one find out? Well, essentially one has to start from this model and to see whether it corresponds to existing physics with all of the existing physical, known physical laws. One sort of has to recapitulate the whole history of physics, going from kind of the natural phenomenon of this model to the laws that it implies. So one of the things we've been trying to do is to automate the recapitulation of physics, to automate physics, and to make it be the case that as we search for universes, that, you know, in a millisecond we can tell, we can recapitulate the whole history of physics and find out whether this particular potential universe is actually something which has physical laws that correspond to what we see in ordinary physics or not. It's really hard. Sometimes there are universes that kind of obviously can't be our universe, but sometimes there are ones that sort of just bubble around and do very complicated things, and where sort of we're seeing computational irreducibility up close and realizing it's very hard to tell whether the thing that we're seeing actually corresponds to the thing that we're trying to model. So even after you've done a search, you can have that problem. I think one of the things that is kind of interesting to see, and it's kind of one of the, you know, as we look at sort of the development of NKS, a lot of actual work that's being done has to do with studying particular simple programs and what they do. And as that builds up, each individual one of those studies of some particular simple program, one day somebody will take that study and realize that that's the critical thing you need in order to make some particular piece of technology or some new model of something. Every one of these kinds of things, when you study kind of a simple enough program, it's sort of inevitable that it will have a historical importance in the development of the field, because when it's simple enough, when it's kind of a natural enough thing to study, it will come up over and over again as the field progresses. The thing that we're also seeing now is more and more kind of case studies of actual searches done in the computational universe. I think it's going to be very interesting to kind of take some of these case studies and kind of be able to do sort of a meta study of what's actually happened in different cases and when it's been possible to find things using particular methods and so on. And that's, I think, something interesting that's going to come in the next little while. Yes.
In your earlier remarks, you talked a little bit about this train example, where these trains are moving around in these carefully coordinated ways. And traditionally, those kinds of problems are attacked by optimization methods.
Yes.
Is it possible that NKS could provide a different approach in that class of problems that are at present attacked by optimization?
Right. So the question is, for things like train timetables and so on that are currently solved by methods like linear programming, operations research, optimization, what does NKS have to say about this? I think you've asked me that before. And actually, my answer is going to change, because when you asked me about it before, I said, I don't see how to make this connection. I'm beginning to see how to make this connection. I think that, and this is part of what can emerge from sort of better studies of kind of how to do searches in the space of programs and so on. As we kind of make that more systematic, so we can get to actually turn that into something which is a kind of an industrial strength kind of method for doing these optimization types of things. So I'm fairly optimistic about being able to achieve something there, though I haven't done it. It's a great thing to do, and it will be an important thing to do. Yes.
I encourage you to emphasize survey methods, because it seems to me that the most cogent criticism of the NKS implicit community when you abuse the fact was precisely that there was too little use of the constraints approach, which is very much the basis of the dynamics. If you take the generating rule, it's simply not that it seems to me that the choices amongst those generating systems is both complex and pragmatic. Would you feel pressed by that to admit that the simplicity is at least demanding?
At least would, what?
That the simplicity of explaining that particular model is at least nuanced by the sophistication necessary to choose that particular model as opposed to another model.
Fair enough. Right. So let me make a couple of remarks about what you're saying about constraints, and then turn to the interesting question you asked about. So about constraints and about kind of their role in physics versus NKS. In physics, one's talking about equations much of the time. One's saying, here's a relation that must be true, that we think is true about the natural world. And these equations make kind of no distinction between cases where, well, let me say, in contrast, in sort of the world of NKS and programs and so on, one's saying, here's a rule, now to find out what the world will do, we run this rule and see what happens. We're not saying, here's sort of a relation about what must be true about the world. We're saying, here's a rule, you can just run it and see what happens. In physics, kind of equations don't make a distinction between the idea of just the initial value problem of here's the initial state of the system, now the equation defines how the system will evolve with time, and things like boundary value problems where you're told, here's what the state of the boundary of the system will be, now the equation will fill in what happens inside of that boundary. Physics doesn't make that distinction. Physics kind of conflates what, when we think about computation, are two very different kinds of problems. In, for example, computational complexity theory world, one is like a P polynomial time problem, and one is like an NP kind of problem. And physics makes no distinction between these things. Now, it could be that the universe is really defined by a constraint. It could be that the complete space-time history of the universe is defined by one constraint. It could be that it's like, the giant, it couldn't be this, but like, the giant calligraph of a monster group or something is the whole space-time history of the universe, defined by a constraint. I don't know that that isn't the case. I somewhat hope it isn't the case, because I kind of hope that in a sense, what is achieved by the progress of time in the universe is something that actually is sort of achieving something. It's actually performing some irreducible task that kind of might almost make one feel justified in one's existence in the universe. But coming to your second point about sort of what we mean by a simple rule, and whether we are kidding ourselves when we say, I'm sort of paraphrasing what you said, whether we're kind of kidding ourselves when we say, here's a simple rule that can be defined by, you know, one line of mathematical code or something that represents our universe. There's the question of whether there's some invariance to that, or whether it depends on us and our whole history to know what we consider to be simple or not. I mean, if we were to have, could it be the case, for example, that it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where our universe and its nature makes us create the mathematica, so to speak, in which the description of the fundamental rules for our universe can be given as one line? I suspect not, but I don't know. And this is something that it's close to, in fact, Greg Chase's algorithmic information theory kinds of questions. You know, to what extent there is invariance to whether something is simple in its description or not. I think I would say that, it's something I've wondered about a lot. As we search for our universe in the space of sort of possible universes, I've wondered a lot what it kind of means if it turns out that our universe is number one, number 10, number 1,000, number a quintillion, etc. I had an experience some years ago searching for Boolean algebra in the space of possible axiom systems. And I wondered whether Boolean algebra, which is something which, you know, we think of as being sort of a foundational idea in mathematics, whether it would be kind of axiom system number one in a kind of natural enumeration of axiom systems, or would it be axiom system number a quintillion? The answer was it was axiom system number about 50,000. I don't know what that really means. I think part of what it means is it gives us some sense of where sort of the mathematics lies in the space of all possible mathematics is. But I think that for the universe, it's something that I consider kind of a fascinating thing. If we get to the point of knowing that our universe and the enumeration we choose to use is number such and such, what will it mean? I can tell you in the enumeration I'm using, it's not one of the first 1,000. But beyond that, there are possibilities. Yes?
Can you explain what kind of proof or mathematical test is fundamental
So the question is, what kind of test is sort of fundamental to demonstrate the universality of a machine? So how does one win this prize? Really, what one's doing in sort of computation universality is sort of a big network of equivalences. I mean, it's kind of interesting historically what happened with computational universality. It wasn't clear that there was kind of one robust notion of computation. You know, in the what was it, 1920s or so, people were thinking about, you know, primitive recursive functions and things like this, and thought maybe they would represent all functions that one could reasonably talk about in mathematical terms, and then along came the Ackermann function and things like that, and that whole sort of idea blew up. And then there were these ideas like lambda calculus and Turing machines that turned out to be things where one could prove precise equivalence. One could prove that with lambda calculus you could emulate any Turing machine, with a universal Turing machine you could emulate any other Turing machine or lambda calculus or whatever. And then there started to be more and more of these examples of systems that sort of seemed different in their construction, yet turned out to have the same ultimate ability to emulate each other. So the typical way that these proofs proceed is to show that there exists, is to essentially create a compiler to say, so for example, to prove that this is universal, the best way would be to make a compiler that will take condition for, let's say, rule 110 or some other known universal Turing machine, and show that you can compile any sort of program that can be run in that known universal system, compile it so that it can be run with this machine as its interpreter, so to speak. So that's kind of the way to do it. One thing to say about computational universality is that it's kind of a notion on top of which things like principle of computational equivalence are built, because the principle of computational equivalence sort of says something more extreme than computational universality. It not only says that lots of systems will show computational universality, it also says that they'll do it a lot of the time. That they could be the case, that it might be the case with this particular Turing machine, that with appropriately elaborate initial conditions, it's possible to make this Turing machine do something interesting and non-trivial and emulate some other machine. But that with the vast majority of initial conditions, it could do something quite boring. I think I know that that doesn't actually happen with this particular Turing machine, because even with a blank tape initial condition, this is what it starts to do. So anyway, that's kind of the best way to prove computational universality is to make a compiler that shows that the machine you're trying to prove is universal can explicitly run the code that represents any other computation. It's actually much harder to prove that things aren't universal, usually, than to prove that they are. Because to prove that they aren't universal, you kind of have to squash them flat. You have to show there's just no way that you can make this system capable of emulating some other kind of system. You have to, in a sense, be able to completely exactly solve for all the properties of the system and know there can't be any way that something more bizarre can happen in it. Yes?
This is two questions. One, when do you expect there might be a department of NKS at a university? Second, if that's the case, will that stifle the development of NKS during in the hands of the university system?
Okay, so the question was, when do I expect that the first department that's primarily focused on NKS will exist at a university? And second, when that happens, will it be a bad thing? I think that the answer to the first question depends. It's hard to predict. It's one of those things where the way it looks to me, it looks kind of irreducible. It depends a little bit on how hard it's pushed. Perhaps it depends on how hard it's pushed. We've sort of been looking at this, and there have been a bunch of universities that have been interested, and more commonly, it's been the upper administration of universities that has sort of recognized that computational science is an important thing, and recognizes that NKS is sort of a core part of computational science. It's not something that's going to kind of come out from the math department or something and break off. That's a much less likely thing to happen. There's a more global kind of idea that computational science is important and so on. In terms of the dynamics of how these things happen, as the larger the supply of potential NKS professors, the easier it is to make an NKS department. That's something that happened when I started the Complex Systems Research Institute that I started. I had, with great effort, managed to get agreement from the university for a rather large chunk of faculty positions. The problem that I had at that time was that in that field of complexity research, there simply weren't enough people who were at the appropriate level of seniority and who weren't sort of who didn't have sort of 99% of their history in some other area, who were available. That was kind of a difficult thing. So I've been concerned not to make that same mistake again, not to push it too early. But we're getting to the point where there's a decent collection of people, including many who are here, who might be relevant for such a thing. In terms of would it be a bad thing? No, I think it would be a good thing. I think that it's one of these things that I think is part of the sort of ecosystem that needs to develop in order to have kind of working on particularly pure NKS be something that can sort of be kind of accelerated in the kind of academic world. I think that. Pure NKS is not really something that ultimately I have not been able to figure out. So I have thought for a long time about the point that there are clearly important technology directions that will happen from NKS, and I haven't. And one might think one could build some kind of system, some kind of structure, where those technology directions, which in many cases will be quite commercially significant. Will somehow systematically feed into the development of pure NKS. I have not managed to figure out a structure where that could work. Doesn't mean to say there isn't such a structure, but I haven't managed to figure one out. So I think that when it comes to doing basic science, we're kind of struck with the traditional models of universities, philanthropy, governments, those kinds of things. Yes.
You said in an interview about 10 years ago, when you were writing this book, actually, that you were very interested in AI. And I'm curious to know if you have been doing any work on AI within this NKS framework, and if you have any comments about it.
Okay, so the question is about, the first statement was about something I said in an interview 10 years ago. That's really scary. the interview, if it said that was correct, I was interested in artificial intelligence and still am interested in artificial intelligence, AI. I think that one thing that I've kind of... In the past, I used to think that the big challenge of AI was to make something that could sort of somehow be intelligent, whatever that means. So I sort of thought there might be some kind of magic feature of brains and things like that that would allow them to sort of be intelligent in a way that one couldn't see in kind of other kinds of systems. Increasingly, what I've realized, I think, is that the problems are somewhat different. I think sort of the key to being intelligent, so to speak, is just doing sophisticated computation. And what we've learned from NKS is that there's tons of systems that do sophisticated computation. I think sort of the problem of AI, as we normally think of AI, is much more the problem of relating that computation to human purposes and to kind of what humans, the way that humans interact with things. I think it's not so much to just get the raw computation done as to get computation done that kind of appropriately relates with humans. So it turns out that I do have a project that I'm not yet ready to talk much about very much makes use of that issue of kind of making, using computation and interacting with kind of how humans work. One of the issues is, when you have kind of raw computation out there, lots of things being computed and so on, how do you like tell a computer what you want to compute? You know, we have computer languages, which are sort of a precise way to do that, but they're a way to do that that doesn't seem like our kind of everyday form of interaction with the world. And so one question is, can we kind of find a way to sort of take all this computation out there that's going on, and can we find a way using our more traditional things like linguistic kinds of forms of interaction to kind of tell a computer sort of what computation it should be doing, and to make it kind of and to make those computations relate to things that we actually sort of care about in the ordinary world. I mean, I think one of the things that I've worked a lot on computer languages, and for example, one of the things that we did in Mathematica was in some sense to formalize the processes of mathematics. One of the things I think is interesting is to see to what extent that same sort of computerized formalism can be applied to kind of everyday sort of situations. And one of the things that I think one of the things I've realized is that if you look at the history of the formalization of mathematics, there was kind of a big push in the early part of the 1900s to say, let's take kind of what we think mathematicians really do, which is to prove theorems and so on, and let's find a way to formalize that process. And that's what led to Whitehead and Russell's Principia Mathematica, things like that. But actually, the formalization of mathematics, that wasn't the most important part of the formalization of mathematics. What turned out was that the most important part was our ability to do computation, to not just to not model sort of this process of constructing mathematical proofs, but instead to deal with the process of being able to set mathematics up so that it could be computed with. So now the same issue arises in kind of representing everyday knowledge, because what people often try to do is to say, let's represent everyday knowledge. Let's try and essentially prove theorems about everyday knowledge. Let's try to find some kind of framework in which we can sort of take what's out there on the web or something and put it into some framework where sort of we can prove things about it. So I'm guessing that there's actually a different way to use everyday knowledge, which has sort of the relationship of that different way to this sort of let's establish facts from everyday knowledge. It's something like the relationship between computation with mathematics and the establishment of kind of an axiomatic theorem-type framework. That's a little bit vague, but it'll turn into a product before sooner than one might think. But, yes?
Yes, I want to talk first to the question about the implications of NKS for questions on the existence or non-existence of God or the nature of God.
Okay, so the question is about what NKS says about God or existence thereof or not. You know, one of the things that I find interesting about NKS is that a lot of the issues that it's ended up confronting are issues that you might have thought that sort of go back earlier than when science was the primary means of kind of intellectual discourse. So a lot of these questions about sort of why is there complexity in nature? Could the universe have a simple rule and so on? A lot of the things, the arguments actually predate modern science. I mean, for example, one of the things that is an interesting observation is that one might ask, how complicated could the rules for the universe be? Could it be that the universe has just incredibly complicated rules? The answer to that is, no, it probably couldn't be, because you know, there are only, 10 to the 90th particles or something in the universe, and if the rules for the universe had 10 to the 100 different cases in them, then chances are sort of every particle would be doing its own thing, and there wouldn't be any kind of order in the universe. And so that was an argument that was used by, was it Aquinas maybe? I don't know my theology history well enough, but it was an early argument. It was an early version of the argument by design for the existence of God, that there sort of is order in the universe, and that's something significant. To me now, the main significance of that is that it suggests that the rules for the universe aren't as complicated as they could conceivably be. They're simpler than they could conceivably be. How simple they are, I don't know. You know, if you ask questions about whether there's sort of an intelligent force in the universe and so on, this is something which kind of gets informed in some unexpected ways by NKS. One of the things that one can sort of think about is whether, and doing real-time philosophy or real-time theology is quite difficult, so I may not get to the straight in real-time here. But one of the kinds of questions is that there's sort of an issue of kind of the hierarchy of kind of us as humans, what we see in nature, the universe, how the universe is structured. And there's sort of a question of whether, you know, we kind of have some sort of perception perhaps that we are kind of more special than some aspects of the universe, but perhaps and that we have sort of a special place in the universe by being somehow more sophisticated than or something than what we see in most of the universe. I mean, but it's been kind of one of the features of the progress of science that we've kind of learnt how we're less and less special. I mean, for example, you know, we learnt that our planet isn't at the centre of the universe. We learnt that there's nothing particularly special about the origin of our species, so far as we can tell. You know, all these things. One interesting feature of every time we learned from science that we were less special than we thought is that sort of science got to make a more general statement. It could drop the footnote that says, you know, except in the case of humans. And that was sort of an important step in the progress of science. But one might think that in a sense, NKS, we view ourselves still as being sort of special in our level of sort of intelligence or computation or something like that. In a sense, NKS shows us that isn't the case either. We can't expect that we have some, through our evolution and development of our civilization and so on, have sort of developed some special level of computational ability that's beyond what we see elsewhere in nature. I mean, the sort of principle of computational equivalence puts us all on kind of a level playing field of kind of what we can do relative to, in computational terms, relative to what the rest of the universe can do. But in a sense, the one thing that I find interesting is that one might say, okay, that's bad news for us feeling special and feeling important and so on, because we're just equivalent to all these little cellular automata and all these sort of systems in fluid dynamics and all this kind of thing in terms of our computation. But kind of the good news is that that so is the universe. The universe is in the same boat. It's not the case that there's kind of the universe up there with its, you know, rules that, and its kind of special construction that's kind of something that's unreachable by us, something that is of a quite different nature than us. It's something that this principle of computational equivalence kind of suggests that kind of there's the universe is sort of as intelligent as we are, which in turn, and we're sort of as intelligent as these things that we view as being sort of inanimate natural objects. So I think I did a better job in some parts of chapter 12 of the book. That was a small effort to try and sort of set out some of the things I think. Yes?
There's one thing from the line of this, and first of all, that's the next. It's clear that computing in Paris would have caused dependency 20 years of Antarctica. Do you think over the next 10 to 15 years, as the processing power continues to race ahead, that there will be opportunities for breakthroughs in computing power and the speed at which it can be calculated in the NKS of Antarctica field, or do you think it will come in?
Okay, so question is, what do I think is going to happen in the next 10 years or so, 20 years, about sort of the progress of speed of computation and what can be done with computers and so on? I think, several things. I think that the sort of the current engineering track of an x86 type architecture faster and faster, that will continue. I doubt that there'll be, despite all the claims that there'll be some fundamental, you know, thing that no engineer will be able to figure out how to make it faster, this is not going to happen, I don't think. I mean, there'll be, it will perhaps require more effort on the part of software folk to fit in with, you know, making things work in parallel, all those kinds of things, but I don't expect anything very fundamental to happen there. I think there may very well be other tracks of computation where some really interesting things happen. I mean, the fact is, we can perfectly well see that if we can do computation at a molecular scale, there's a lot more computation that we can do than we can do with the, you know, 100,000 electrons per bit that we're dealing with right now in semiconductor devices. Will we get there? How long will it take? I don't think it'll be incredibly quick, because I think it's going to require just a lot of kind of very detailed engineering work. I mean, even once we had a good idea about how to sort of really implement nanotech computation, it's still going to require lots of engineering work to make it really happen. However, I think one sort of hopeful sign is the following. And one of the things we learned from NKS is that doing universal computation is a lot easier than one might think. You don't need, you certainly don't need a whole Pentium chip to sort of do computation. You can expect computation to get done in systems that have much simpler component parts. So now the question is, let's say somebody proves that this Turing machine is universal. And let's say, then the question is, and it seems not inconceivable that we could make a molecule that would implement this Turing machine. The question is, would that actually be useful or not? And that depends on sort of the question of whether the compilers that we can write for these kinds of systems are such that we can actually take a realistic program, a realistic, you know, piece of Mathematica code or something, and compile them down to a system like this. At the beginning, that looks really hopeless, because these systems look really simple. You know, the systems look really simple. The sort of the compilers you might expect to use, you know, it looks like you need these incredibly complicated things to make them do universality and so on. My guess is, though, that it's a lot less hopeless than it seems. I mean, if somebody told you you're going to do everything you do with NAND gates, and you're going to compile everything, every kind of computation that you might think about, down to these little circuits involving NAND gates, you might think that was completely hopeless. And if you were to look at, but in fact, the layers of work that have been done in compilers and higher-level languages and so on have allowed us to take, you know, these sophisticated computations that we describe and indeed get them down to these tiny little NAND gates. My guess is that at first, if one manages to implement systems like this in molecular ways, at first the compilers will seem to be a big impediment, but that will not turn out to be a really big impediment. The one thing I found, for example, with this little axiom system that I found for logic, single axiom, simplest possible axiom system for logic, you might have thought with a simple axiom system, it would be really painful to prove sort of typical interesting theorems of logic. It's not. I mean, there's a 100-step proof that you have to give of commutativity of NAND. But once you've done that, the little axiom system is really no less efficient than the great big axiom systems that have been sort of custom engineered to be axiom systems. So I suspect the same kind of thing will happen here, but I can't prove that. Yes? It's in chapter 12 of the MKS book. It's I'm sure if you look at the online book and you look up axiom system, it'll pop up probably quite quickly. That was an easy question. I guess.
Yes. Seems like universal computation appears to have a very low boundary in nature as well. But you can say that not every time these systems use the full power of computation, right? So what does it mean that universal computation is you can find it everywhere, but it's not, that you can use it for many capabilities?
Right, so the question is, many systems may be universal, but are they actually doing things which are sort of make their universality worthwhile? Or, it could be that the systems are in principle universal, but most of the time they're not actually making use of that universality. A lot of what we use in present day engineering is indeed that exact situation. Systems that are in principle universal, but we use those systems to do rather simple things. What I'm claiming is that, in fact, if we allow those systems to do more complicated things that make more serious use of their universality, that's much more effective and efficient. I mean, I think that if we look at systems in nature, there are sometimes cases where, traditional physics, for example, has tended to concentrate on those examples of systems which are not, in which kind of they're not sort of justifying their universality. Let's take fluid dynamics as a favorite example of mine. When we look at sort of a flow of a fluid at a comparatively low speed, it will be laminar and kind of flow in a simple way. That's undoubtedly not making serious use of the sort of computational capabilities of the fluid. When the thing flows faster and you get turbulence and you get all this sort of random and complicated behavior going on, that's something which I think is sort of really making use of the capability of the fluid to do universal computation. So the question of how frequently is universal computation used, I think the answer is it's fairly frequent in nature. Physics has tended to avoid talking about it because it doesn't have a lot to say. It's not terribly common in engineering today because, again, we don't have the capabilities, the tools, to make good use of it in engineering. But that's something that I believe is going to change in the years to come.
Yeah, I just want to ask about the name. It can't be NKS forever, right? Is there a proposal that you think, or are you expecting the community to just have some sort of emergent name, or have you given some thought to it?
Have I thought about the name? Yes, I thought about the name for endless amounts of time. The main thing to do is not to not to have a name that kind of restricts the concept of what. What the thing will be, in the sense that when one looks at it, it has to be a meaningless name. I mean, it's because if it has a meaning, it's a meaning that is already linked to something that people already know about. If it's about programs, in a sense, it's not really about programs. It's about systems that follow rules that could be computer programs, but they don't need to be computer programs. I've kind of been. In my efforts at naming, I have a company that just has my name on it, which is good because nobody knows what it does, unless they think it's a metals company that does tungsten mining or something. With Mathematica, we had, in a sense, one of the biggest challenges in communicating what the point of Mathematica is to explain that it isn't just kind of the math that people think is the math that they do in school and so on. And so that's kind of a bad experience in a sense because, when I named Mathematica, I was kind of thinking about mathematics in a much broader sense than I later realized most of the world actually imagined mathematics to be.
You could use a word from five for finding a name.
Yes. That is indeed one. Anyway, it's always good to use one's own methods to try and solve problems. And indeed, we've certainly thought about that. Yes.
Yeah. I have a comment to make, and if it is a simple rule at the base of all complexity, that does not necessarily negate the presence of God, because we didn't make the rule. We just discover it, we can talk about it, we can explain it, we can use it maybe, but we didn't make it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the this question of if one day we sort of hold the rule for the universe in our hands, so to speak, what does this mean for how we think about why the universe exists and so on? I simply don't know. It's kind of an analogy that I've thought about a bunch, because it's kind of interesting to see how it's played out historically. It's, for example, when Newton was studying, the orbits of planets and so on, the conclusion that he came to is once you start them off, the way that they'll go for the rest of time is determined by his law of gravitation and so on. But what he said was, how they get started off is something that he could not have anything to say about. And for a long time, philosophers used to say, this statement that, the number of the planets is 9 or 7 or whatever it was, or 8 or whatever it is at the moment, what's that? I know that time. I don't think it's the finest moment in the history of science. the statement that's often made is sort of that the number of planets being 8 or 9 or whatever is not a necessary truth about the universe. It's just something that happens to be that way, and sort of was started, like Newton's kind of initial conditions for the planets, by something outside and beyond what was being talked about. Of course, now we know that for a star of about the size of the sun, if you look at an ensemble of possible initial conditions, there's a good chance, the overwhelming chance is that you'll end up with between 5 and 15 planets by this stage in the development of the solar system. And it's the same thing, for example, with Darwin, perhaps he had other particular issues for reasons for saying this, but the statement that kind of, he had the idea that sort of natural selection would be sort of an inexorable force, I think the last sentence in Origin of Species, right, has a very nice quote about how, just as the Earth goes circling around the sun according to the fixed law of gravity, so species, are being and will continue to evolve, which is, he kind of thought that it was sort of an inevitable thing that natural selection would lead, I think he was wrong about the fact that it leads to complexity, but I think that it would be, continue to be sort of a force in the development of biology. He sort of was not able to say what would happen with the first living thing. And, again, we now know a lot about that. So these are kind of historical tales that kind of get one thinking about what will be, a couple hundred years from now, if we've actually managed to find the simple rule for the universe, will we then have some overarching way to understand that at some time in the future? Yeah.
And one more thing also, our brain is not man-made.
That's true.
Yeah. It's man, woman, man.
Well, no?
To operate with the Navier-Stokes equations, on a computer, you have to make some discrete approximation to the Navier-Stokes equation. You have to make a bunch of assumptions about what might be true, and you have to sort of do your numerical analysis to try and find out whether what you're simulating on the computer has anything to do with what the original sort of perfect mathematical equations might have been. In doing most of what we do in MKS, because we're usually dealing with these discrete programs and so on, we don't have any of those kinds of issues. I mean, when we look at the evolution of a cellular automaton, for example, it just does what it does. And, you know, the bits are the bits, and there's no issue of having to do numerical analysis to find out whether what we get in the system is a correct reflection of some underlying sort of real equation. Now, the next question is, when you have a model of something, like, let's say, a model of fluid dynamics, how do you know that that model relates to what you actually see in the real world? I mean, the answer to that is, at some level, no model will ever be a perfect representation of what you see in the real world, because models, by their nature, are idealizations of things. You say, in my model, I'm going to capture this or that feature of the system, and I'm going to idealize away everything else. And then there's always some sort of controversy about, you know, did you correctly represent, I don't know, you know, let's say you're modeling snowflakes, did you correctly represent what happens when, you know, two snowflakes run into each other as they're falling down? So there's always this issue when you make models of whether the idealizations that you choose to make are idealizations that somebody else who might want to use the model would have chosen to make or not. I think that the one exception to all of this, you know, models are usually approximations where some things are idealized away, other things are captured and not. And to me, the question of whether a model is a representation of the world, the right operational question is whether it's a useful representation of the world. That is, when you want to kind of do something with the model, when you want to build a piece of technology, when you want to make or predict the weather or whatever else, whether this model turns out to be something that, at a practical level, achieves the objective you want to achieve. Now, there's one exception to this whole business about how models are approximations. The one exception is, if there really is a fundamental theory of physics, then that model will be the one case in which it isn't an approximation, in which there'll be kind of a precise model that is kind of the ultimate model that sort of precisely represents everything. Yes?
How do you find that, though? How are you going to know? What's your fitness function?
Okay, so question is, if one thinks one has found the fundamental theory of physics, how is one going to know it? Well, so, as I was saying, I mean, you know, computational irreducibility has a nasty consequence for this, because you start your sort of potential model for the universe, you start some little graph, it starts growing, pretty soon you have a billion nodes, you run out of memory in your computer, it's bubbling around doing all kinds of things, okay? How do you know that this thing you've got is the first 10 to the minus 200 seconds of the universe, or whether it has nothing to do with it? Well, it's hard. I think what one has to hope for, so there are a couple of things to say. What one has to hope for is that some features of our universe, of the physical reality that we experience and that we have studied with the existing laws of physics, that some features will be recognizable by a limited amount of running of this rule. So a typical thing one tries to do is to use automated theorem proving to prove the existence of invariants, for example, in this rule. Those things may not be a precise invariants of the physical universe. They may be approximations. In fact, we don't know. But that would be a good sign. If those invariants were precisely the case, that would be a sort of a lucky way to know that one had something that would correspond to the actual physical universe. So one has to look at these various sort of indications of whether one has something that corresponds to the actual physical universe, but I can't say for sure whether a billion nodes is enough or whether you need, you know, 10 to the 50th nodes before you can start to see something where you can actually reproduce what's going on. I would say one thing, though, which is that there's a question. If one is close, if one gets close to finding the sort of an ultimate model for physics, could one have something where, well, it's almost the ultimate model for physics, but just slightly wrong? Okay, I think that's very unlikely, because By the time the model is simple enough, there just aren't very many models in the space. So as you kind of, you don't get to kind of turn a knob gradually to kind of change, you know, say, well, I got everything right except the mass of the muon was wrong or something. You don't get to kind of turn a little knob to change the mass of the muon, because these different models, if they're simple enough, the distance between one model and the next is so great that if you turn that knob just a tiny bit, there isn't any muon at all. There might not even be any notion of space. So I think that one of the things I do think is encouraging for if there is in fact a simple model of physics is that we probably don't need the next generation and the next generation and so on of particle accelerators to tell whether we've got the right model. Because most likely the distance between a model that's right and a model that's that isn't right is so great that the consequences will be readily apparent in the physics that we already know. The chance, if there's a simple model, if there's a simple model, then the physics we already know is undoubtedly sufficient to tell us exactly which that model is. We don't need to go and find all these little details of further physics to work that out. Now, you know, knowing that the model we have, so once things start to fit together with the physics we have, we will, I think, rapidly get very optimistic about the fact that we have the right model. There's questions about which aspects of physics will be generic to a whole class of models versus specific to particular models. I have guesses about that. I know already that, for example, gravitation theory and general relativity is fairly generic to a large class of models that you get. You could derive the relativity theory, both special relativity and general relativity, emerge in a large class of models. That's once a general feature. That doesn't distinguish between different models. I suspect that, for example, the number 3 for the number of dimensions of space that we have is a fairly decent discriminator among models. I suspect that, for example, by the time we deal with particle physics and the particular, you know, particles that we see, that by the time you're dealing with any of that stuff, you've pretty much perfectly discriminated between different models. That's my guess. We should wrap up.
You can do this forever if I want to, but we have a schedule to keep tonight. We go till 10:30.